halfway through the period of the 9 days. For anyone who has our booklet, if you look halfway through the booklet, you will see a page that outlines all of the schedule for Tisha B'Av. So we're going to have many different minyanim options, but I just want to bring to your attention that on Tisha B'Av afternoon, we are going to have two shiurim for men and women. One is at 1 o'clock with Michal Horowitz, that will be here in the main shul, and then I will be giving a shiur at 2 o'clock following Michal's shiur. Michal's shiur is sponsored by the Metzger family, commemorating the third yard site of Pearl Brown, Pearl Bas Yosef, and my shiur has been generously sponsored by Chaim and Yael Hamnick, in memory of Chaim's grandfather, correct? So we're looking forward to learning together with everyone. I happen to find it ironic that the one day of the year that you're not supposed to learn Torah is the day when we have the most people learning. It's fascinating. I think when you talk to the people who run the data analytics on YU Torah, they'll tell you that there is no greater day of people who are following and streaming online than on Tisha B'Av. But be it as it may, I hope that our Divrei Torah will be meaningful. I hope that it will give people an opportunity to really join together and understand the profundity of the loss of the Beis HaMikdash, and we'll have the opportunity to be uplifted together. And that's really what I wanted to speak about this morning. Just as we know, life becomes so busy, and we don't have an opportunity all the time to really tap into all the things that are going on around us. So I just thought that this morning was a great opportunity for us to just take a few moments and tap into the understanding of what it is that we're yearning for when we talk about the lack of Beis HaMikdash, when we talk about the lack of Eretz Yisrael in our lives. Before we do that, I'm very proud to welcome back many of our members. I see you've grown exponentially since last week. Stephanie, times two, I guess, both of you, welcome. And Lori and Shira, who I met on Shabbos. It's a pleasure to see all of you. And it's a pleasure to spend Shabbos here with you. It's a pleasure to have you in our community. And we're happy that you are back, and we should continue to grow together. So let us begin with the beautiful words of Rav Shlomo Wolbe, who was one of the great, great Balei Machshava of our generation. And everything here in Hebrew I'm going to translate, so there's nothing to be concerned about. If you don't read Hebrew well, that's fine. Just follow along outside, and that's okay. So let's begin with what he writes. We know there's a concept that we refer to a life of Torah and mitzvos. We refer to a life, an observant life, as kihen chayenu. That this is our life. Now, what does it mean when we say a life of Torah and of mitzvos and of doing things that connect us to God is our life? What exactly does that mean? So obviously it's a nice way to speak, and we talk about, oh yeah, this is life. But what does it mean in simple terms? So Rav Shlomo Wolbe explains so beautifully as follows. Kol taryag mitzvos mitzvah achas hein. All of the mitzvos, all of the observance that we do throughout the year are all part of one composite whole. And that is what we refer to as kihem chayenu. Hachayim eina mischalkim le'ivarim. Take a moment and think about our lives, about our bodies. When somebody asks, how are you doing? You don't say, my eye is doing well. You don't say, my toe is feeling okay. Happens to be in the other direction. Rav Asher Weiss was here last week and we were talking, and he was, unfortunately, he has something wrong with his knee, so he was limping, and I had to wheel him in a wheelchair in the airport, and somebody stopped him and he says, so how are you doing? Which is a strange question to ask someone when you see them in a wheelchair, how are you doing? So he says, you know, my mother just passed away at, I think she was 94, and he said she was a Holocaust survivor, went through a whole lot in her life, had psychological trauma. And he said at like 91, 92, 93 years old, she was still in her full capacity intellectually. And people used to ask her, how are you doing? And she said, my left leg is hurting and I can't walk with it. And my right arm, I can't really move. And my eyes don't really see well. And I can't hear anything you're saying, but I am fine. So that's the attitude. I am fine. All of these other things may not be exactly the way they should be, but I am fine. So here he writes, "Hachayim ena mischalkim le'ivarim." When we talk about our own lives, when we talk about our bodies, we don't say, this part of my body is fine, this part of me is not fine. We say, I'm okay or I'm not okay. And if a part of me is not okay, it means the whole me is not okay. Ela kol haguf hu organism echad, our entire body is made up of a bunch of different components, millions of different components, and yet they all come together to make the whole, the totality of who I am. Hanoseya tachayim. Kach kol ha-mitzvos biyachad. So too, he says, this is what we mean when we say an observant life is life itself. What does it mean? This is our life. Im yishalu adam ma ko'ev lo yoter. If we would give someone a choice and ask them, what would you prefer? Would you prefer that we amputate your finger? Would you prefer that we take out your eye? Or would you prefer that we do some kind of incision into your abdomen and remove something? They would say, I would prefer none of the above. I don't want any of these choices. Obviously, if they're medically suggested, then we do what we have to do. But nobody would want any of them. And he writes, Lo yirtza b'shum ofen l'shar eza ke'ev yoter noach lo. Person wouldn't want to have to make that determination. Well, which one is going to be less painful? Well, I would hope not to have to do any of the above. Hine ha'ayin eno ever shahanashama teluyabo. He says, well, the truth is, I can start breaking it down, saying to myself, well, my eye is not something that I can, you know, I could live without an eye. It's not something that my life depends on. Obviously, life will have to change a little bit, and I'll have to reorganize and restructure, reformulate how I live. But for the most part, a person can live without one eye. And he says, you think about a finger. Well, the same would apply for a finger. And a person's going to start making all these calculations back and forth. He says, that would be a ridiculous conversation to have. And so too, he writes in the next paragraph, Kach ha-Torah eina mavdila bein mitzvahs kalos v'chamuros. The Torah does not differentiate between, well, this mitzvah is considered like an eye, and this is like a leg, and this is like a heart. We have 613 obligations. We have 613 opportunities to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with God Himself, and all of them are part of the organism that is our life. And we don't start making a calculation, well, this is more or less important, and this is something that's more vital than the other. Sometimes you speak to people, and they say, you know, chesed, it's just not my thing. Charity, it's just not my thing. It's not because I don't have money. It's not my thing, it doesn't speak to me. Prayer, davening, tefillah, that's just, I don't connect, it's not my thing. Shabbos, you know, observing Shabbos, that's just not, it's not for me. It's not my kind of thing. Everything else is fine. Tznius, all kinds of things that we can come up with. I do everything else. I have a structure in my life, how I do things, but this is just not, it's not my style. It's not my thing. It doesn't really work that way. The same way in a body, it doesn't work that way. We don't just say, this is not my thing. Now, that doesn't mean we don't struggle with certain things. The same way sometimes a person has a weak eyesight. Person has a certain arm that's stronger than the other. Person has a certain ability that one part of the body can do better than the other. So too, there are some of us who have the ability to do certain things better than others. But it's the expectation that we're all going to live the totality of life, of observant life, which is a composite of all of these different components put together. So then he continues, and he says as follows. Ein ha-Torah mavdila bein suge ha-mitzvos. Look at paragraph number 3. The Torah does not differentiate between different kinds of mitzvos. Ha-adam bal ha-natios note levakerosan ha-mitzvos ha-krovos yoter le-natios v'tva'osav. He says, while it's true, we all have natural predispositions. Some people are more social, and therefore for them, it's easier to do certain things than for others. The mitzvah of bikur cholam, of visiting the sick, will be easier for a person who naturally knows how to do such things than to someone who's naturally an introvert and does not know how to interact with other people. It's just not what they're good at. So while it's true, he writes, that certain aspects of our lives may be stronger because of predispositions that we have, that is true. But in the end, we have an expectation. The bottom line is that all of us are considered to be equal in the expectation that is put in front of us. My father often says over that when Rav Moshe Feinstein passed away, there were many, many great maspidim, many great people who gave eulogies on Rav Moshe, who was the leader of our generation. And one of the eulogies was, my father often quotes it, that he spoke about the different disqualifications of a karban, of a sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash. If you would bring an animal to the Beis HaMikdash, which kind of animal would qualify as something that can be brought as a sacrifice? Well, obviously it has to be kosher. If it's non-kosher, you can't bring it as a sacrifice. But beyond that, there are many other laws and rules that govern exactly what can be brought and what cannot. And one of the disqualifications is what's referred to as sarua. If an animal is a sarua, it is not allowed to be offered as a karban in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, what does a sarua actually mean? Sarua means that the limbs are disproportionate. So you have one limb that's longer than the other. You have one ear that's larger than the other. If the animal, taking one look at it, seems to be disproportionate, that's something that would not be qualified to be brought as a sacrifice, as a korban in the Beis HaMikdash. And they said about Rav Moshe Feinstein as well, that perhaps a person who lives life as a sarua, a person who lives life where something is more or less emphasized or accented than something else, that's not a perfect observant life. We don't believe in the extremes. A person should never be on the extremes for anything. A person should always realize that everything needs to be put into the right proportion, into the right perspective. And it's never appropriate to blow one thing out of proportion as opposed to something else. There's always a price to pay for that, right? So there's a beautiful story about Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that he once saw. There was a young man who was walking together with his father in the streets of Yerushalayim on Shabbos afternoon, and he saw that the young man was carrying nothing and his father was carrying a stack of chairs. And he asked this young man, "Why are you not carrying the stack of chairs when your father is standing right next to you?" And he said, "Well, I'm careful not to carry in the Erev. I'm careful not to carry outside on Shabbos, and my father has no problem with it. So we needed to get a stack of chairs from our neighbor down the block to our home. We're having a lot of company, so my father's carrying it and I am not." And Rav Shlomo Zalman pointed out to him that that's a disproportionate understanding of the totality of Jewish life. When you weigh out the two options in front of you, when you think about kibud avim, the respect, the honor, the dignity that one's supposed to have for their parents, versus carrying outside in the streets of Yerushalayim that has an Eruv, which one would you say takes precedence? Well, let's think about it. Let's break it down. One is a mitzvah, one is an obligation, midah araisa, one is a chumrah that you took upon yourself. I mean, you have to understand, everything needs to be done in the right proportions. Everything needs to be judged and valued and really understood very carefully before making a decision. And that's what they said about Rav Moshe Feinstein, that the greatness of him, I mean, there were so many aspects to focus on, but one of his great tributes was the fact that he was a balanced person. And in all aspects and areas of life, he was equal. I remember Bernie Silverstein, Alav HaShalom, told me an amazing story. I remember I once said a story about Rav Moshe. So I don't remember if he or his wife were from the Lower East Side. Anybody remember? He? So he told me a story that he was engaged at the time, or first married. He said they had no children, and he had a car. And he was driving together with his wife or his kala, his fiance, whoever it was. They were driving together in the Lower East Side, and his wife was in the front seat. And they pass down the street, and they see Rav Moshe Feinstein standing on the side of the road waiting for a ride. So he rolled down the window. Actually, when you have to roll down windows. So he rolled down the window, and he asks him, "Can I give you a ride? Where do you need to go?" He says, "Well, I need to go a few blocks away to the yeshiva. I have to give a shiur, and I'm just not strong enough to walk. I'm waiting for someone to pick me up." So he said, "Well, we would love to give you a ride." Rav Moshe said, "Well, I would love to come along." So Bernie asked his wife to go to the back seat of the car. He was going to take Rav Moshe in the front seat. And Rav Moshe said, "If a husband and wife are not going to sit in the front seat, I'm not coming in this car." And it was such a beautiful story. It makes a lot of sense. It reminded me, I told him, I remember we were once in Eretz Yisrael, and I had taken my father to Ramot to have a discussion with Rav Asher Weiss about something. Anyway, all three of us had to go to Yerushalayim afterward. We were going our own ways, but we were all going to Merkaz Yerushalayim. So I remember we called the taxi came, and it became a whole discussion who's sitting in the front seat. So Rav Asher Weiss and my father were each telling each other, "You should sit in the front." Finally, Rav Asher said, "You know, Shai, I don't know how to figure this out, but you definitely don't belong in the front, so you just go there. We'll sit in the back together." So sometimes it works in different directions. So the point was, they were saying, the Talmidim of Rav Moshe were saying that he was such a balanced person in all aspects of his life, in his Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, in his interpersonal relationships. He was just as scrupulous as he was in his Ben Adam L'Makom, in the way that he interacted with the Ribono Shel Olam, in the way that he interacted with God Himself. And that is something that we find is so important. So the Chafetz Chaim then takes this a step further. Let's read what he writes in Number Beis. Chafetz Chaim says, well, what happens? Suppose you have somebody who succumbs to sin, which is all of us. So the Chafetz Chaim says, so then what happens? What do you do then? If the Torah is meant to be a complete composite whole, and we need to have an expectation that we're going to be able to observe everything, then what happens when I'm unable to do everything, when I have a lacking in some area of my life, which is only natural for all of us? We all have challenges in some way. So the Chafetz Chaim writes as follows, where it says, Davar Beito, the second line, Kasher Hadavar Lehepachu, Shahaish Shekvar Avar Al Eza Mitzvah Mi Mitzvah Satorah. Let's say you have someone who has failed in that mission. Let's say you have someone who's just not able to do everything. A lovely shmarat mo yoser shelo yaver od al kol panim al yeser al mitzvahs. At least, he writes, you should be careful to emphasize other aspects of Torah to the best of your ability. If that's where I'm up to, then that's what I should hold on to. And he explains it again. He gives this mashal, he gives this parable to a person's life, to an organism, to a body. Kemo she'ira be'echad she'nafal rikavon rachmana litzlan be'echad me'evarv she'begufo. Suppose, he says, you have someone who has a infection, a gangrenous organ, biyado uveraglo achas, in his hand or in his leg, v'yamahir likro lerofim v'yichatru ha'evarim eile, and this person is going to quickly summon a doctor. The doctors are going to say, unfortunately, we need to amputate, we have no choice, the infection is going to spread, v'achar kach hisbonenu, and then they realize that the infection is actually spreading. And meanwhile, you're running around to this doctor, to that hospital, to try to figure out what I'm supposed to do. In the meantime, you're losing time because more organs are rotting and more organs are becoming dysfunctional. So what do? He says, Tzarech lachtoch gamas yado o raglo hashnia. And now they say, you know, we would have first had to only amputate one arm, but now it has spread. We have to amputate the second arm as well. Vayech b'chi gadol meyod, and he begins to cry and he's breaking down. He doesn't know what to do. Vayischane laharofim ula yesh eitza lihimalei tes yado hasheni. And he says, maybe you have a way to save my second arm. And the doctor turns back to him and he says, well, why are you so bent out of shape? We already cut off one. So what are you so upset about? You already know what it means to have an amputation. He says, well, you cannot compare the two experiences. A person who loses one arm, at least they still have the other. Imagine somebody who loses the ability to use both arms. You can't compare those two experiences. And therefore, writes the Chafetz Chaim, a person in this kind of understanding, a person who has a certain part of their religious life that's just simply not activating, it's not doing what it's supposed to do, you're not feeling connected to it, it's just not something that you're able to overcome that hurdle at the time where you are right now, in this moment of life, in this experience. Well, says the Chafetz Chaim, at least make sure that the infection doesn't spread. At least make sure not to amputate an extra organ than you have to. Try to emphasize the things that you feel you are able to overcome. Try to pay attention to the things that you feel are healthy and are going well and are being accomplished, because that's something that right now I'm able to sustain. It's something I'm able to uphold. And I think it's a very beautiful comment that he writes. Now, while that is all true, that we have a organism which is the makeup of our religious lives, Reb Shimshon Pinkus does point out that the same way in a body we do have certain organs that are considered to be vital organs, so too we have certain aspects of our religious lives that are considered to be vital organs. And without them, we cannot have a life. One of those, he writes, is our focus on Eretz Yisrael, is our connection to the land of Israel, is our understanding of how prominent a place that is in our lives. And that, he says, is what we would refer to as Evarim Shehaneshama Teluya Bahem. That is potentially one of the vital organs. Now, you can go through all of Chumash, you can go through all of the Torah and Mitzvot and find a number of things. But there is nothing that is emphasized more in the pages of Chumash than our connection to the land of Israel. And I've said this so many times. It is of no mistake that every one of the great Jewish leaders throughout the pages of Chumash, the very first conversation that God has with them is about the connection to the land of Eretz Israel. Think about it. Avraham Avinu, the father of our people, what is the first conversation that we're told about that he has with the Ribono Shel Olam? God comes to him and he says, Lech lecha me'artzecha mimoladetecha el ha'aretz asher areka. I want you to leave wherever you are, and I want you to go to the land of Israel. That was the first communication he had. What is the first recorded communication that Yitzchak Avinu has with God? Well, Vayihira ba'aretz, there was a famine in the land, and Yitzchak is not exactly sure what to do. He begins to travel out of the land of Israel to try to find some food somewhere. And the Ribono Shel Olam, God stops him and he says, no, Yitzchak, stop. Shchon ba'aretz hazos, you need to stay here in the land of Israel. It's the first time he has a communication. Yaakov Avinu, the first communication he has is, V'hinei sulam mutzav arza v'rosha magia hashamayma. We know that Yaakov has this vision, and he has a ladder that is on top of his head, and it is all the way up to the sky. A very beautiful scene. But what is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him at that moment of his life? He says, don't worry, I'm going to bring you back to the land of Israel. Now you're about to go out on a journey, on an odyssey. You don't know exactly where it's going to take you, but don't worry, you will be returned. V'hashivosicha el ha'adama hazos, I'm going to bring you back to the land of Israel. Don't worry about it. Israel is where you belong. Now you're just taking a little break, but you'll be back here. And that's what it's about. Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest of our people. What was the first conversation he has? We know the burning bush, the sneh. And what does God tell him? Go to the Jewish people and promise them that there's going to come a time when we'll come to the land of Israel. Yehoshua ben Nun, the one who took the place of Moshe Rabbeinu, the first conversation God has with him is Chazak ve'emas. Be strong, Yehoshua. You're now leading the Jewish people, and what is your task? To take them into the land of Eretz Yisrael. This cannot be a coincidence that the first conversation that God initiates with every one of the great leaders of our people was revolving the topic, the land, the significance, the centrality of the land of Israel in all of our lives. And it's something that we need to think about. One of the strongest supporters in the late 1700s for the Aliyah movement was the Vilna Gaon. And it is many of his students, many of his disciples, who are the original founders, the original pioneers of the Yishuvim in Eretz Yisrael. And much of what we have today is only because of their bravery, and so much because of their strength and their commitment to rebuilding the land of Israel in the late 1700s, early 1800s. If you've read up about it, you'll know a whole lot more. But the Vilna Gaon made a fascinating comment, and he said that this is a very unusual mitzvah. The mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, of living in the land of Israel, is very, very different from most mitzvahs that we do. Take, for example, we have the mitzvah of shaking a lulav. It's a mitzvah that we observe with our hands. We take the dalet minim, we shake it with our hands. Other mitzvahs we do with our mouths. We pray, we use our mouths to daven, to connect. Is there any mitzvah, says the Vilna Gaon, where you find that my entire body is able to be involved in this commandment, in this connection? I step into the land of Israel and my entire body is part of this experience. And he writes, the only other mitzvah that we have where we find the same kind of idea is the mitzvah of sukkah. Both by sukkah and by Eretz Yisrael. By entering into the land of Israel and by entering into the warmth of the sukkah, we have an opportunity to do something with our entire body. So I once spoke about this in shul. There was a woman who was very upset, who said, you're always anti-women. Never thought I was. But she was very upset and said, you're always anti-women, how do I know? Because you didn't say anything about mikvah. Okay. So let me address that. First of all, I'm not the one who made this comment. I'm just quoting verbatim from the Vilna Gaon. So, take it up with him. Why he did not include mikvah is a very good question. But the second thing I pointed out to her, which I think is more important, is mikvah has nothing to do with women. So I'm just as anti-men as I am anti-women. I hate them all, right? I don't know. I love them all. A mikvah is something that is used equally in the pages of Chumash by men as it is by women. There is no difference at all. Nowadays, yes, we're more familiar with women using a mikvah than a man. But a mikvah is something, let me make clear, they don't use it together. Men and women used to have separate mikvahs, as they do have today. But a mikvah is not something that is designated for women. A mikvah is something that is equally used by men as it is by women. Now, why the Vilna Gaon did not include it in this list, I don't know. I'm sure there's a good explanation. But let's leave that comment aside. If that's something that was bothering you, it bothered somebody else as well. But I have nothing against anybody in the room. Be it as it may, the Vilna Gaon writes that these two mitzvahs are unique in the way that we have the privilege, that we have the experience of full immersion, of full absorbance into the mikvah, I guess you would say. Of full involvement. Every part of my body is involved in this mitzvah. And what is the connection between sukkah and Eretz Yisrael, explains the Vilna Gaon, the connection is that in both of these experiences in our lives, we have a complete and total reliance and dependence on the Ribono Shel Olam. When I go into my home at night and I lock the door, I feel protected. Maybe not in today's environment anymore, but it used to be that way. I had an alarm. The police were functioning very well. We had a pretty safe community. And I felt pretty protected. I felt like I'm okay. I didn't need God that much. I don't need God that much. Now, a religious person understands that God is always looking after us. We have a mezuzah on the front door. Right? We ask, we want for God to protect us all the time. But when we go out into the sukkah, we are exposed to the elements. And we don't have that protection. And we show our dependence and our reliance on the Ribono Shel Olam himself. When we leave the comfort of our home and we say, God, we're outside, we're exposed, and we're in your hands. And the same experience when we talk about Eretz Yisrael. You know, people talk about the rise in anti-Semitism all over the world. And they say, you know, the only answer is you have to go to Israel. There's no more dangerous person for a Jew to be than the land of Israel. Think about it. What are the odds that a Jew is going to be killed in the United States? What are the odds that a Jew is going to potentially lose his life in Israel? That comment I never really understood. You should protect yourself from the anti-Semitism all over the world and go to Israel. That's not the reason to go to Israel. The reason to go to Israel is because Eretz Yisrael is the focal point of our lives. It's where Jewish history is unfolding. All of us are left on the sidelines. It's where the next chapter of Jewish history is being written, and we are not a part of it. We are maybe lucky enough if we can be a footnote in the back of the book, but we are not a part of it. That's where Jewish history is unfolding. That's where we're supposed to be. It's the aspiration of every Jew for thousands of years to be in the land of Israel. That's why we're supposed to be there. Not because it's safer. There's nothing about Israel that's safer for us at all as individuals. And says the Vilna Gaon, what's special about the experience of being in the land of Israel is that we have the opportunity to put our complete faith and reliance in God when being there. It makes no natural sense that the state of Israel is even there. It doesn't make sense that we have millions of Arabs who are surrounding the state of Israel, threatening to destroy it at every moment, and yet they're still there. I think they say in the name of Ben-Gurion that to be a realist in Israel means you need to believe in miracles. That's what being a realist in Israel is all about. It is a miraculous existence. There is nothing about it that runs naturally. There's nothing about it that makes sense at all. Actually, when I was in Israel together with your group, I got into a taxi one day, and it was the day when President Biden was in Yerushalayim, and I said to the taxi driver, like, you know, I feel bad. Your parnasa is going to get destroyed in the next couple of days because all the streets in Yerushalayim are going to be closed. You're not going to be able to work, and I feel sorry for you. And he looks at me and he says, what are you concerned about? I'll go home. I'll learn. I'll listen to some Shiurei Torah. I'll say my Tehillim. God will give me a parnasa. What are you worried about? You're worried for me. I'm not worried for myself. I said, this is the beauty. This is what living in Eretz Yisrael is all about. It's understanding that I'm in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Imagine here, the streets are closed. I can't get to my office. I can't get to my meeting. What am I going to do? We start going crazy. Here, taxi driver in Israel knows that for 2.5 days, he's not going to have anyone to take in his car. He's going to be off of work. What does he say? It's okay. God will take care of me. I'll be fine. That's what it means to put your reliance in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to live in the land of Eretz Yisrael. And that, writes the Vilna Gaon, is what we have as a uniting characteristic between the mitzvah of Sukkah and the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. But one of his students took it a step further and he said, if you look at the laws that govern building a sukkah, you will find that one of the mitzvahs that we're told is when constructing a sukkah, it has to be something that is actively built, as we refer to it as Tasev Elo Min Ha'asui. It cannot be something that comes into existence on its own. It has to be something that is fashioned, that is created by a person. Only then is the sukkah able to be used. And writes the Talmidei Agra that the same applies to the land of Eretz Yisrael. It is not something that is going to happen on its own. The privilege of being in Eretz Yisrael is something that only happens through the active role that we play in supporting it, in being involved in everything that will build the land of Eretz Yisrael, and that is something that is so critical, and once again, a connection between the land of Eretz Yisrael and the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah. If you turn the page to the other side, you'll notice a startling comment of the Gemara. Let's read the Gemara together. Ksuvas daf kuf yud. Says the Gemara, Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Le'olam yadur adam be'eretz Yisrael. A person should choose to live in Eretz Yisrael. Afilu, I think I emphasize this more than anything else. Every good Jew needs to at least think about why they are not living in Eretz Yisrael. There are reasons to justify our existence here. There are reasons to justify why we are here. But the premise needs to be that a good Jew is supposed to be living in the land of Israel. Now, you're staying in America because you need to make a parnasa, because you need to support your family. That's a very good justification. You're staying in America for health reasons, also a good justification. You're staying in America for a variety of reasons, it makes sense. But to stay in America just because I never imagined myself living in the land of Israel is unacceptable. And it's the job of every good Jew to think about why it is that I'm not living in Eretz Yisrael right now. It pains me every day when I wake up here in Chutz La'aretz. I don't want to be here. I love everybody. But I don't want to be here. I want to be there with all of you. I feel uncomfortable that I'm still here. Every opportunity that's come up for me in Eretz Yisrael, I've been told by my Rabbeim, who I reach out to, by my teachers, that you have a job that you're doing in America, and you have a role to play, and you're supposed to be taking that leadership position seriously, and you can't just jump ship. Now, I find that strange, because basically it means the leaders are going to be the last ones standing here in Chutz La'aretz. I don't know. The job is to encourage everyone to do the right thing and to go to Israel, but then I hope we'll have the privilege and opportunity to go ourselves. But we all need to be thinking about it. And the Gemara takes it very seriously. The Gemara says, Le'olam yadur adam be'eretz Yisrael, afilu be'ir sharuba ovde kochavim. Even if I'm going to move to Eretz Yisrael and live in a city where most of the inhabitants of the city are not Jews, they're not going to have a positive influence on my religious life. They may influence me in other ways, but as far as religion is concerned, if I'm living in a community where they don't have a Jewish population, of what good is that? Says the Gemara, no, it's still better to live in the land of Israel. Va'al yadar b'chutz la'aretz. Do not live outside of Israel. Shekala dar b'eretz Yisrael. Here's the startling comment of the Gemara. Whoever lives in Eretz Yisrael, dome kimisheyesh lo elo'ah. It's as if he has a God. And somebody who lives in Chutz La'aretz, sorry to say, dome kimisha ein lo elo'ah. It's as if he doesn't have a God. Now what does that mean? Really? It's as if all of us living here in Chutz La'aretz don't have a God. I mean, we connect, we daven, we pray, we keep Shabbos, we do all kinds of things. We do have a God. So what does the Gemara mean? And this is a very troubling comment of the Gemara. Many suggestions and interpretations have been said over the last 2,000 years. But something that profoundly impacted me was the comment that is quoted by Rav Moshe Shtermuch in his Sefer on Chumash, where he writes as follows, he explains it as follows. What do we mean, he says, you look here in number Dalet. What do we mean here when we say that someone is supposed to live in Eretz Yisrael? And someone who lives in Eretz Yisrael is kimishiyesh lo elo'ah. It's as if he has a God. What does that mean? Let's read it. Malas hadar be'eretz Yisrael. What is the value of someone living in Israel? Is it just Zionism? Is that all it is? No. If it's Zionism and nothing plus that, that's not what we believe in. What is the value of living in Israel? He dafka mi shemargish shuhudar be'eretz Yisrael. It means a person who feels what it means to live there. Umasha amr chazal hadar be'eretz Yisrael, when it says someone who lives in Israel is as if he has a God, ein hakavana, it doesn't mean someone who's physically situated in the land of Israel, but rather it means somebody whose perspective is as if I live in the palace of the king. If living in Israel does not change a person's perspective, does not make me have a different sense, a different attitude of what kind of life I'm living, then it's not valuable. Then it's kimisha ein lo elo'ah. And in the converse, he says, somebody who lives in Chutz La'aretz, somebody who lives in America, but aspires to a life being in the palace of the king, is the same, can have that experience, can recreate it. Living in Eretz Yisrael is supposed to give us a perspective. You are now in the embrace of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have now been entered into His inner confines. That's an experience you can have in America as well. You just need to create it. But he writes and he argues, there's no value in a person living in Eretz Yisrael when the perspective remains the same. Living in Israel just for the sake of living there because it's so wonderful is not a value. The value is when it changes a perspective and a mindset. And that's really what we think about. And that's what this Gemara means, he says. Look at the next paragraph, and this made me feel a little bit better, where he writes in his first volume of his responsa, in his first volume of Tshuvas, he says, Meragla b'pi Adonai Avi Mori. He quotes in the name of his father. Mutav lios Yehudi b'chutz la'aretz ha'meshtokek lalos arza. It is better to be a Jew who's living in Chutz La'aretz, who is on a constant longing, who is on a constant journey of yearning, of agonizing to be living in the land of Eretz Yisrael. It is better to be that than to be the person who lives in Israel. It's better to live here and to be yearning that I aspire toward that unbelievable experience than to be living in Eretz Yisrael and just being jealous all day that I wish I was out. I wish I wasn't here. Look what they have in America. And that to me was a very comforting feeling. A very comforting sentiment, I guess. But that's really what this is about. A person who has an opportunity to live in Eretz Yisrael and to appreciate what that means, that is what makes the experience valuable. A person who is, for whatever reason, unable to go at this moment, but is constantly pining and yearning and looking forward to that experience and understanding what it means, is still able to recreate that understanding of Kimishi Yeshlo Eloah. It's interesting. The Tashbetz writes in one of his tshuvas, he was one of the great Rishonim. Tashbetz writes, somebody asked me, what's so valuable about living in the land of Israel? Why should we go there? So he says, the Gemara tells us all kinds of nice things about living in Israel, but what's the bottom line? He says, imagine you go into Buckingham Palace. He was before Buckingham Palace, but imagine you go into the White House, you go into Buckingham Palace, there's a certain aura that you feel. There's a certain mode of conduct that we have when we're in a place which is majestic, when we're in a place which expects a certain kind of conduct from all of us. And that's the way we all feel. Nobody had to tell you the rules. Yeah, maybe little children need to be told how to behave in these places, but every adult knows instinctively when you walk into such a place what is expected of you. And therefore, he says, what's great about living in Israel is the opportunity for a person to understand the expectation that God has of all of us, of how we're supposed to live. That's why Israel is valuable, because you're living in the palace of the king. And you're having an opportunity to be in a majestic place every moment of your life, which means you're going to instinctively, naturally behave differently, the same way you would if you were in a majestic place anywhere else in the world. But that's what Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be for all of us. That's really what the experience is supposed to bring us to. So let me just close. We're going to end a few minutes early. We say in Tehillim, Shir Hamalos B'Shuv Hashem Ashivas Tzion, Hayinu Kecholmin. When we talk about our return to the land of Eretz Yisrael, we refer to it as a chalom. It's as if we were dreaming. Now, what exactly does it mean when this description of the return to Eretz Yisrael is spoken about in terms of Hayinu Kecholmin? It's as if we were dreaming. So this is actually a debate. It's a dispute among the Rishonim how to interpret that phrase. The Ibn Ezra writes in his commentary on Tehillim that perhaps what it means is as follows. There are certain things that to us remain as a fantasy, remain as an imagination. It's something that we cannot conceive in reality. It's just so beyond our understanding. So there are things we dream about, fantasies we have, that we know will never come true. And when we talk about our return to the land of Eretz Yisrael, we describe it as Hayinu Kecholmim. It's a fantasy. It's something that we never imagine can actually be true in our lives. That is what the experience of the return of the Jewish people to Israel is going to look like and feel like. Something that we can only have imagined in a fantasy, in a dream. It's only an imagination. But that's going to be the reality of our lives. Second interpretation, the Radak writes, in the name of his father, that sometimes a person is waiting and waiting for something, and they can't wait, they have such anticipation. But then when you finally get to the goal, when you get to the end, you say, wow, that just felt like a moment. It was like fleeting. It was all worth the wait for this beautiful outcome. And writes the Radak, we have been waiting as a people for so many generations to have the opportunity to return to Eretz Yisrael. When we finally get there, we're going to say, Hayinu kicholmim, with all the pain, with all the anti-Semitism, with all the difficulty over all the generations. Hayinu kicholmim, this is going to be so fantastic. This is going to be so otherworldly. We're going to say, it's almost as if the last 2,000 years were a dream. It just passed so quickly. Even though as we were going through it, it was so painful, and so difficult, and so intense. But in the end, Hayinu kicholmim, when you see what's there at the end, you understand that the wait was well worth it. But perhaps another interpretation could be as follows, and I think this is most relevant to our generation. For anyone who's a school teacher, so you know, you can be the greatest teacher, the greatest educator, but sometimes you're going to have a student who's in his or her own world. Whatever you try to do, they're just not there with you. However engaging you might be, they're just not paying attention. They're not making trouble, just in their own little world. And suddenly, in the middle of everything, the teacher claps their hands, or the teacher will do something unusual. And suddenly you see the kid comes back from another world and is suddenly snapped back into the reality of the classroom. Well, they were there all along. They saw everybody around them. They were just in a complete daydream, in a complete fog. They're not here, they're not present. And perhaps when we talk about the return of the Jewish people to the land of Eretz Yisrael, perhaps it's the same. We watch and we marvel at what has happened, the explosive growth of the land of Israel in the last 100 years. There is nothing natural about this story. This is lemala min hateva, if there ever has been anything that's lemala min hateva. This is beyond any natural order that could have possibly been dreamt or imagined. And you continue to watch the survival, and not just the survival, but the thriving culture in Eretz Yisrael, and the strides that they've made in every aspect and area of life. We're a fledgling country, and yet, look how much we are significant on the world stage. Look what we have accomplished. Look at what we have been blessed to bring to the world and to enhance the experience of life all over the world. And yet, with all of that, I sometimes feel, Hayinu kicholmim, that we are so inattentive, that we're so oblivious to this reality, that we're so absent-minded and distracted when it comes to this incredible miracle that's unfolding in front of our eyes. And every day that the existence of the land of Israel and the people of Israel are there, it is such a great and profound miracle. And yet, we're distracted by all the things that are so irrelevant in the grand scheme of things. Hayinu kicholmim. What are we worried about? We're worried about whether the stores on Central Avenue are open today. I have the same fears as you do. We're worried about whether, you know, I always marvel. You go into the bagel store, maybe I'm just a simple guy. I go in, I say, I need a dozen bagels, but the people in front of me never have the same order as I have. I'm amazed. Now, I don't drink coffee, so I don't know. But the amount of specifications that people have when they walk into a local store and ask for this kind of coffee with that amount of this, and this amount of that, and that kind of milk, and this kind of egg. I'm looking at it, I'm like, really? How much time did you think about this order before you came here? This is what's on your mind. Now again, enjoy life. It's great. HaKadosh Baruch Hu put lots of great things in the world for all of us to enjoy and to take advantage of. But look at the bigger perspective. You ever been into one of those stores when the person working behind the counter does not have exactly what you asked for? You ever been the one who's heard the wrath of the customer in this neighborhood who, for whatever reason, is not being served exactly how they wanted it? Really, is this your problem in life? Look what's going on. You're like the kid in the classroom who's here, but he's not here. Who's in his own little world, who's worrying about his own little things, who's in his own little bubble and has no understanding of what's going on around us. Hayinu kecholmim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us every so often to have an insight into how incredibly miraculous this existence is. And I almost feel as if the 9 days gives us an opportunity to just stop so much of the monotony of life, so much of the rhythm and routine. We're not going to weddings. We're not busy with simchas. We're not listening to music. So what are we doing? We're not eating meat. So what are we doing? How are we spending that time? What are we doing? The point is that it should be an opportunity to be shocked back into reality, to think once again and focus, what is this dream about? What is my aspiration as part of this dream? Where do I fit into this dream? Do I fit into it at all? Am I a part of this unbelievable prophecy that is actually unfolding and coming true in front of all of our eyes? Am I a part of it? Is there any part of me that feels connected to it? And that's really what this time of the year is supposed to be for. It's the opportunity, so to speak, for the teacher, which we don't have, but it's the opportunity for all of us as a community to be shocked back into a reality, to understand, time to come back and realize what the priorities in life need to be. What is the central focus of our lives? What are the Evarim Shehanashama Teluya Bahem? What are the most vital organs of a Jewish spiritual religious life? What is it meant to be, and is that where my focus actually is? Or am I caught up with all the things that we're all caught up with and not leaving space to worry about the things that are most important and to appreciate that which is most valuable to all of us in our religious, communal, and spiritual lives? So I feel very strongly that during the 9 days we have to at least give a little bit of our thought, a little bit more of our attention to things that are so critically important to the life of a Jew, to our essence and definition as a people, to who we are as individuals and as a community. And this is really the opportunity that not only the 9 days, but most prominently Tisha B'Av gives us. We sit on the floor. Why do we sit on the floor? Why do we do all the things that we do? Why do we take Limud HaTorah out of our experience on Tisha B'Av? Why do people not learn on Tisha B'Av? It's because our focus is supposed to be one which is really looking at something which is so critically important that so often during the year does not have enough focus. And this is our challenge, this is our opportunity, and this is what we aspire toward. It's what we look forward to every day of our lives. It's what we daven for more often than anything else in the tefillah. You look through the siddur and you'll notice it. This is something that we so much display as a prominent aspect of what Jewish life is supposed to be. And we look forward to the day when we'll have the opportunity to once again, Sheyibana Beis HaMikdash.